This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back to The Daily Digest. I'm Sharmila Ganesan, together with Juliet Jacobs and Lim Soo Ann. And now on to our second story. We do have a poll going on Twitter.
Yes, so last week, an American food channel actually described nasi goreng as resembling fried rice. So, you know, which of course angered many, many South Asians. So from that whole crispy rendang saga to even to this, you know, are we overreacting when the West gets our food wrong? So we asked you that on Twitter, and so far 63.8% of you have said, no, we are not overreacting, while another almost 40% of you have said, yes, we are overreacting. So do take that poll. You can always tweet us at BFM Radio. You can also send us any WhatsApp message with your thoughts at 018-789-8899.
So you might think that the humble fried rice is about as uncontroversial as it can get, right? But last week, you know, there was a bit of an online kerfuffle over exactly that, over nasi goreng. It all began with a video by Los Angeles-based Indonesian rapper Rich Brian, where he demonstrates how to make Indonesian nasi goreng. Nothing wrong there. It's actually a really fun video. But when American media channel Food Insider tweeted the video out, the accompanying caption said, resembling fried rice, nasi goreng is made with a thick, sweet Indonesian soy sauce called ketchup.
Goodness. Also, needless to say, the response from the Southeast Asians was swift and merciless, and also often hilarious as well. Indonesians, Malaysians and Singaporeans were very quick to point out that nasi goreng doesn't resemble fried rice. It is very literally fried rice. So within a few days, there were thousands of comments and shares and jokes, of course, about Food Insider snafu. For example, just a simple tweet that said, quote unquote, fried rice is nasi goreng, facepalm. And that garnered more than 7,500 shares and likes. And other tweets responding to the video include, quote unquote, of course it resembles fried rice. Nasi goreng is literally fried rice. Another one was, it's the very same thing. You white people made Google Translate, but never bothered to actually use it for cross-checking a simple phrase or vocabulary. And the last one, you, admin, had one job. And finally, I love nasi goreng, best eaten with telur goreng, which is another popular dish resembling fried egg. See, bro, the best in everyone.
Yeah, many variations of those. I like my nasi goreng with ayam goreng, which resembles fried chicken.
Well, others also pointed out how even the second part of the caption messes up. So it says nasi goreng is made with thick, sweet Indonesian soy sauce called ketchup. Well, when ketchup literally translates to soy sauce. And overall, most of the responses added up to a general sense of exasperation at the apparent ignorance, the lack of research that went to the post, and perhaps is best summed up by tweets like this. Seems like you need a Southeast Asian in your team.
Agreed. So as of now, there hasn't been a response from Food Insider. But for those of us who follow the food scene online and on social media, and let's face it, that's most of us, there is a familiar pattern here that has been common in the last few years. And, you know, at the risk of perhaps being, I hope I'm not generalizing here or being unfair, but generally a Western media outlet or channel writes or creates content related to food from a particular culture. And then they somehow get it wrong or they make a mistake and it goes viral. And this gets a large amount of clapback and criticism from people belonging to that culture.
Yeah, so here are some of the recent examples of this happening, right? So close to home in a way, back in 2018, there is, of course, that infamous crispy rendang incident. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure most of us still remember that. That was when Malaysian-born contestant of MasterChef UK, Zaliha Kadir Olpin, was criticised on the show for her chicken rendang not being crispy enough. Of course, that sparked a massive backlash online from Malaysians, because when is rendang crispy?
Right.
Well, in 2016 as well, food channel Bon Appetit got called out by Filipinos when they presented a version of the famous Filipino dessert Halo Halo, but with ingredients like banana and brown sugar, mashed berries and gummy bears and popcorn.
Yes.
Yeah. And another one, it was also in 2016, the New York Times was called out online for a recipe they shared for pho with broccoli and quinoa, which many people of Vietnamese origin pointed out was not pho at all. Mm-hmm. And then there was the time when Time Out London made a video of Shan Shanghai's soup dumplings or Xiao Long Pao and showed how they should be eaten. So get this, apparently by popping them like pimples with chopsticks, which is absolutely not the way to eat them. And, you know, that video got Asians really, you know, all over the world responding in disgust. And last year, Chef Jamie Oliver, he actually got called out for introducing a new produce called jerk rice, which was inspired by the Jamaican jerk marinade. Except traditional jerk seasoning contains things like allspice, scotch bonnet chilies, soy sauce, ginger, lime, while Oliver's mixes garlic, ginger and jalapenos. So, you know, really not jerk at all.
So, yes, it might seem like sometimes these are overreactions, but there is a deeper issue that's going on here, right? It seems like what people are reacting to is the idea of an outsider, often a Westerner, telling them about their own food or culture. And in the case of the crispy rendang scandal, for instance, you know, people were calling it things like neo-colonialism. And then there's the sense of ownership or discovery that many of these articles or videos take. For example, the Time Out London one, where they're presenting or talking about a centuries-old dish or tradition like they've just discovered it, and then packaging it for a largely Western market that knows very little about its origins or the culture that surrounds that food.
Exactly. And when it comes to Western adoption of other cultures, many commentators point out that it is often selective and still loaded, you know, with these really racist undertones. So food and culture writer Clarissa Wei, in a series that she wrote for Vice in 2017, talks about how, in places like the US, for example, Chinese food is viewed as cool and trendy, while Chinese Americans continue to face discrimination. So she also talks about how the very foods that are now being celebrated for their newness, were what was used to be made fun of for Asian Americans, with their food habits being called weird or gross.
Yeah, and this isn't dissimilar to instances in the UK where curry is often jokingly, or I feel like sometimes quite seriously by some of the Brits, referred to as a national dish. But Brits of South Asian origin are still often subject to discrimination, and where the word curry itself is often used as a racial slur.
Yeah, so food is not just a deeply important topic to many people, it's often deeply political as well. So to get some insight into the cultural politics of when it comes to writing about food and creating content about food, I spoke to Bettina Chua Abdullah, who is the founder of the Feiku Award for Food and Drink Writing, as well as the editor of a food anthology called Telltale Food. So I asked her, when writing about food from different cultures, how can food writers ensure that they are doing so with awareness and respect?
I would say that really begins with the decision on the part of the writer to respect the food in the first place. So I think you need, as a writer, to say to yourself, what I'm writing about, this food, this is important to a community of people that I might not be a part of. And then you assess, you perform a self-assessment of what you as the writer are equipped with when you start out. What can you as the writer authentically write about the food of another culture based on your first-hand experience of it? When we first started the Feiku Award, we put out some pointers for writing about food, and the very top of that list was original research. And so if your only experience of, let's say, Tom Yam Goong is the Maggie Mee version of Tom Yam, this is not going to equip you to write compellingly about an iconic Thai dish. So when you use that term awareness, you decide where you want your writing to go and you start gathering the information and the experience. If you eat a food, that gives you one level of awareness. If you watch someone else prepare it, that gives you another level. If you cook it yourself and you start shopping for the ingredients and you learn how they grow, that will widen your awareness greatly. So you may not actually use all of this information in the final story that you write, but the chances are greater that you're not going to get your facts wrong and that you won't unwittingly give offense, and that you will also understand where to give weight and emphasis in your writing. The other part of your question is respect, and I'm glad you mentioned that. I would say you come to a story clean. You don't bring your biases. You don't make assumptions that are based on your experience or taste. But I think we can approach with empathy. when the community that you are writing about is making a type of food that is foreign to you, that doesn't mean that they're any less passionate about their cuisine than you are about yours. I think it's really, respect is really a very simple thing. Mind your manners.
So there have been a number of, you know, these online uproars or clapbacks, you know, in recent years when it comes to Western representations of particular cultures' food. Now, how do you see food writing or food journalism as a space where non-mainstream voices are reclaiming their space?
Sharmila, I'm not sure really what you mean by non-mainstream voices reclaiming their space, but let's just put it that somebody has an experience of going to a bookshop and looking in the food section and finding that the majority of the authors of books on Asian food are Westerners.
Mm.
Then, yes, we Malaysian, Singaporean, ASEAN, Asian food writers probably have a lot of space to claim. Because we certainly do have all of this wonderful knowledge and history about food documented through the centuries. You just have to look at ancient Chinese and Indian and Arabic medical texts to start with. There's plenty in there about food. There are botanical studies that go back centuries. There are maps which show you trade routes in which produce, spices, nutmeg, and all the sort of things that traveled the Silk Road were moved around different regions. That's all, you know, the genesis really of food writing, loads of material. If we Asians don't write about our food, someone else will. So the thing about food writing is that in it, you will find the story of humanity. We humans are the only species that cook our food. We are the only species that tell stories. And so the story of humanity is something that's very compelling, both for readers and for writers as well. Now, if we Asians are not going to write about our food, somebody else will. And if that somebody else is a Westerner, and that person does so with awareness, the awareness and the respect that you spoke about right in the beginning, and strives for authenticity, how can we find fault with that?
So when it comes to your own experience with the Feiku Award, as well as editing the anthology, what have you observed when it comes to food and how it represents identity?
What the Feiku Award is a platform for writers to articulate what's important to them in their relationship and their understanding of their food culture or another person's food culture, but why and how it's meaningful and important to them. What we've found with the anthology, which, you know, is a selection of 31 stories that has been taken from over 150 entries, is that it's all about identity. Yeah, identity is a sort of, it becomes a sort of shapeshifter when it comes to food. I think most people who are interested in food writing, know one of the world's most famous dictums, and that is, tell me what you eat, and I will tell you what you are. And in the anthology, what you get, in addition to understanding more about the person who's written the story and the culture and the food, you get these pathways opening up for you as a reader to connect with. And sometimes it's not necessarily the actual dish, the actual food that you connect with, but with the values or the experience or the condition that's expressed in the story. And if I can, I want to share with you one of them, which is called A Greeting of Cassava. This was written by the youngest person who was featured in the book. She was 15 when she wrote this story. Now, you as the reader, right now as the listener, you may not ever cook chicken with cassava leaves in a length of bamboo. But I think you will be very moved by a lovely story of a young Iban girl cooking this dish, which is called manok pamso in her language, cooking this with her grandfather, in which the very presence of these simple foraged greens represents for her and her grandfather a time of peace. Because in the story, you find out there was a time that they could not even go out to forage because it was dangerous to do so. So this is an interesting take on food writing. This is an interesting perspective that says so much about the identity of the person, and it is not just about what we eat.
That was Bettina Chua Abdullah, founder of the Feku Award for Food and Drink Writing, as well as editor of Telltale Food. And that anthology is actually currently out in bookstores locally, if you want to check it out. And I think it's really interesting what she says, isn't it? Because for so many people, food is not just about the food itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's a connection to their stories, their childhoods, their culture, a real sense of identity. And that's probably why they get so worked up when it's misrepresented.
Exactly, especially in a media organization, which you would think would get their research right.
Yes.
And or do some research in the first place rather than just assuming it resembles something. But, you know, on social media, we did ask you over on Twitter, you know, whether we Southeast Asians, we overreact, you know, when the West gets our food wrong. And so far, about close to 60% of you have said no. And of course, another 40% of you have said yes. We did get some responses to that tweet. Michael Chang, who is, I think, a writer, he said, "I'm particularly careful when writing about food or usually drinks I'm not familiar with. So I usually interview someone who actually is instead." Mm. Very wise indeed, Michael. Mm. And That's My Full Name has said that their ignorance is remiss. Eric Kaur, however, says that why do we still need white man approval of our food? Is it a colonized mentality? If we are self-assured, we just laugh at their ignorance. Instead, we are going to dedicate a program to dissecting this. Well, I think Eric gets this whole point wrong. We are dedicating this to say that they need to do their research. It's not that we need their approval.
And actually, even what the backlash is actually, I don't think they're seeking their approval at all.
At all, yeah.
They're, in fact, I think, doing exactly what Eric says they should do, which is laughing at their ignorance.
Yes, calling them out,
which I think is well-deserved, because if you don't do your research well, then you deserve to be called out for it.
Exactly, yeah. And you need to point out when somebody is, taking, and of course, you know, if we don't speak out against it, right, they're just going to assume that is the correct thing.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And especially, and I guess especially for us in Southeast Asia, food is such a part of our identity, of our culture. Wherever you go in Southeast Asia, people are so proud of their food. And this is just our way of showing that, look, we don't want people to get our food wrong because this is part of who we are.
Exactly. And we also got a message over on WhatsApp. Maggie had this to say. She said that someone told me once that taking offense is very much a personal choice. It's also often advised that we should avoid being petty if one wants to be the bigger person, especially if someone else has made a mistake out of a lack of knowledge. But I suppose all these good advice are fast getting outdated, judging by the vicious comments cropping up nonstop in social media. There would be so much more harmony if we practice the policy of keeping silent when we have nothing good or beneficial to say. I must say I disagree with you, Maggie. I think some things like this need to be called out. Yes, you don't need to go down the nasty route, but making fun about it and, you know, pointing out that they did not do their research, I think that's fair.
Actually, I must say, I quite enjoy the sort of humorous tone that a lot of these responses take on, because, you're right, I don't enjoy it when they become nasty or personal either.
True.
And definitely, we know that these social media spirals can turn vicious quite fast. But humor, I think, is actually a great way to point out just the, the silliness or the ridiculousness of that original mistake that was made in the first place.
Especially in this case when it's like one of the tweets says something that can be resolved with something as simple as Google Translate.
Yes, exactly. I do enjoy, though, the fact that enjoy maybe not the right word. I like the fact that actually what's happening now is that people are being held accountable.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you are going to place yourself as an expert, and that is what you are when you put out content.
Yeah.
You do need to know your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the case of MasterChef UK, if you're judging a competition, you need to know your stuff. And if you don't, the response is immediate now. And in a way, I think that's just the balance of it.
Yeah, and it's just good to keep people on their toes. I'm sure that the channel is not going to make that same mistake of, you know, being so lax with their research and, you know, actually going to say what the thing is properly. Mm. We do have another message on WhatsApp. Lily says that she doesn't think that we're overreacting. She does think that it's amusing that we are, though. It just means that we take our culture very seriously.
And our food.
Yes, and our food in particular.
Well, I do have a question, though, for the both of you. What is your favorite kind of fried rice that resembles nasi goreng, or nasi goreng that resembles fried rice?
Nasi goreng ayam. Yes, nasi goreng ayam.
Wow, okay.
Yes, that's my favorite.
Nasi goreng kampung.
Well, you know, mine is actually a very basic. I love just that simple Chinese fried rice, that classic. I don't know if there's a name for it, but like if you go to a Chinese coffee shop and you say, I want fried rice, the one you get, that's my favorite.
But that's so fascinating, isn't it? In Malaysia, you have so many types of fried rice. The list just goes on and on.
Yep. And you were just asking me before this, Suan, about whether, because you have Malay-style fried rice and you have Chinese-style fried rice, whether there was an Indian-style fried rice. And I was telling you how it's not really a South Asian thing, but in Malaysia, you actually get a fairly Indian-y style fried rice in a lot of mamak shops because of the melting pot of cultures we have here. Don't mess with our fried rice, man.
Agreed.
So you can continue to share your thoughts with us at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. You can also drop us a message on Facebook. Just look for BFM The Bigger Picture if you'd like to connect with us there. If you've missed any part of today's show, you can download the podcast on bfm.my/dailydigest, on the BFM app or on Spotify. Well, we will leave you now with Put Your Money Where Your Mouth Is by Jet on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.